Hello and welcome back, folks. So today I'm going to talk to Ethan Peck. He happens to be my boss at work, but also I think he's great at conversations. And so there was this one topic that stuck from when Ethan interviewed me. I'm thinking it was maybe January of this year, so January of 2023. And the exact topic was, so, you know, there are two types of people. There are people who are very technical and, you know, they know that technology very, very well. And there are people who are, let's call them people focused, right? So they're good at handling people. And then the other group, the first group, is good at handling technology. So Ethan and I spoke briefly about it. And I think Ethan's point or argument on that was there need to be two separate career paths. Otherwise, it may be a disaster, you know, a recipe for disaster. So with that, I'm going to stop talking. But actually, before we get into that, Ethan, can you first maybe tell us a little bit about yourself, right? And then get to that.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me, Agnel. Pleasure to be here. So a little bit about myself. My career has been slightly windy, but within the data realm, you hear stories like this all the time, so maybe it's not as crazy it'll seem. I, from a young age, always had a fascination with meteorology. I always wanted to tell the weather. And so, lo and behold, while I enjoyed programming in high school and mathematics and physics, I ended up going to Cornell University for undergrad in atmospheric science, which is a fancy way of saying meteorology. And after I finished my 4 years of undergraduate work, decided I really wanted to continue on that path and become a professor. So I ended up going to University of Colorado Boulder for my PhD in atmospheric and oceanic sciences, where, not that anyone would care, but I studied energetic particle precipitation and its impacts on the middle atmosphere, specifically greater than 30 keV electrons, if you care, less than 2 MeV. I'm sure there's someone out there that cares about this. It was a fascinating field and I enjoyed it. And so then after I finished my PhD, I did a postdoc/lecturer position at Columbia University. And while I enjoyed teaching and I enjoyed my research, something about academia didn't work for me. It just wasn't a good fit. And so I decided maybe I should try moving into industry. I originally thought I would go into industry, still within the domain of atmospheric science, but it was hard to find a position. People weren't really looking for PhDs in the atmospheric science realm outside of research positions. And so I ended up going to a program called Insight Data Science. Insight is an education startup. They're basically a recruiter. So they take PhDs, and at the time, it was free for the PhD. I went into this program. I didn't have to pay anything. It was like an 8-week boot camp, essentially, where you do a data science project and they teach you all about data science in the industry. They introduce you to a whole slew of companies. Really a great program. And then at the end, they shop you around as the recruiter to several companies, and then you get recruited and they get a recruitment fee. So that's kind of how they paid the model. I think nowadays, they had to make ends meet. That wasn't enough. And so nowadays, if you go through that program, they would they charge you some percentage of your salary for the first couple of years, but still a fantastic way to get out of academia and into industry, and one that I certainly recommend for anyone thinking of that path. So after I got through Insight, I was hired at a company called Tamer. They do entity resolution using machine learning, which is a crucial step in what's called master data management. And I was part of the services team there. I joined when it was a very small company and I got to see it move to a slightly larger. So I think it was like 40 people when I joined, and I got to see it grow to 150. And while there, over the course of about 5 years, I kind of moved up the ranks until I was part of the leadership team, reporting to the CEO, doing basically anything and everything odd jobs. So this would involve InfoSec, IT, a smattering of DevOps, but not a ton. And then still a lot of professional services. I supported the sales team. I supported the marketing efforts. I supported our legal efforts, just basically anything that required technical input. And also continued to own several of our largest accounts. But as things go, eventually I decided I wanted to try something new. I made a move over to ZoomInfo. And that's where I am today as a director on the data team. And I get to oversee several different functions. So there's data quality and monitoring. There's data innovation. And there is data partnerships, which is, Agnel, where you come in. So it's a fun and exciting life and a bit of a windy road to get to where we are. But I almost never talk to anyone where the road isn't somewhat windy. So
yeah,
there you go.
So thank you, Ethan. And I'm going to remind you about the question again. And I should have actually divided them into two. But either way, I think it's always good. So career ladder, Ethan, good at technology, good with people, over to you. So your thoughts.
So there is an issue within industry as a whole, where we tend to conflate what the role of a manager is, a person manager, as opposed to a technical leader. And we often conflate it that a person manager, like a manager of data science, is also a technical leader within data science. And sometimes that's true, but I would argue it doesn't have to be true, and it shouldn't be true by nature. There is a difference between being a technical expert and being a person leader. And the skill set required and the kind of passion and drive you have, sometimes those don't mix. If you are a person that wants to be recognized as a technical expert, that wants to lead technical projects, that wants to write, these big blog posts on technical subjects, being a manager is not the path to get you there, right? This, we tend to downplay in society the importance of IC roles, IC being individual contributor. And what we should really be doing is encouraging those IC roles to broaden their function, not just being sitting on a laptop typing away and never seeing the world, but being a technical leadership role. If someone is a senior or a principal data scientist, they should be leading projects with teams. And you can lead a project and have a team on a technical subject without having to worry about their absences or their professional development or their career path, because those are topics of a manager, of a person manager. And to be clear, I care very deeply about that person management role. But in so taking that role, I've accepted that I'm not also the technical leader in everything. I have a lot of technical experience, but certainly the people I manage have more technical experience than I do in their particular area or function. And that's okay. And that's a thing to get comfortable with. But oftentimes we tend to think that like the manager of a team also has to be the technical leader of that same team. And that can severely hinder how the hierarchy of your org is built. And it also ends up hurting the people that report to that person. Because if that person wants to be a technical leader, they're not going to show a lot of interest in your professional development. They will because they're required to, right? But like they don't necessarily care. It's not, they don't go to sleep at night thinking about, how am I going to get this person promoted? And I think that ends up creating a world where there's a lot of bad managers. And I think anyone that's worked You know, anyone over the age of 21 that's worked in a company has met a manager that they didn't like, right? And a lot of the time, those managers don't actually want to be managers. They want to be technical leaders. They want to work on projects. They want to lead projects, but they don't actually want to manage a person's professional development. And that's where they end up conflicting, right? Because you get on a one-on-one and that manager just wants to talk about the projects. And you just want to talk about when's your next promotion and your raise and your compensation and your professional development and your title and things like that. They don't want to talk about that, either because they don't have the interest or because it's not a topic that they're particularly passionate about. And that's not a knock on that person. It's just their title and their role doesn't match really what they're trying to do. It's probably not good for the company and it's not good for the people. And it causes retention rate issues. There was a study at some point, I don't remember who did it, that said that about when you lose a person, it costs almost double the salary of the person you hire to take on a new person. And when you think of retention in those terms, it's very expensive to lose people. And losing people because of a bad manager, it's like an unforced error. Right. You don't need it and it, no one wants it. And so just don't do it. And so I generally stress people before going into a management role to think really deeply about, do they actually want to manage people's career progression? Or are they just interested in being leaders? If you're interested in being a leader, there is an icy track for you at most companies. That IC track is, you know, senior principal, distinguished engineer, fellow. There are paths for people on that IC track that are every bit as respected as the management role, but maybe 100 years ago wasn't. But today these roles exist and people respect it. If someone says they're a fellow at Google, you could bet they're every bit as respected as any SVP, if not more so. So
yeah,
there you go. Mm.
That's interesting. And I guess for companies that don't have such a path, this may be something that they take away as well, right? So because I've seen a few where after a certain point, you may be the best at writing Python code, and you know, if you want to grow to that next step, then it has to be, you have to manage people. And if you like it or not, that's the only way, that's career progression. And
And that often happens, especially at kind of mid-sized companies, where they don't have enough people that they could dedicate to promoting, you know, literally paying people to be a higher level and not do both roles of management and technical leader. And that is certainly a pain point. And I'm not arguing that that this is going to work for every company. I think eventually as companies grow, they hit a point where they're capable of switching out and then they don't. And that's not great. Some companies can't switch. They need people to play multiple roles. And then certainly the smaller you get, you end up having to. Like if you're a startup with only 50 people, you can't afford to have technical leaders and people leaders and have them be completely separate roles. I know, for example, when I joined Tamer, right, I was doing sales calls. I was doing customer success calls. I was doing services calls. I was writing code into the product. So I was an engineer, right? You were doing every role, right? So when you're at a small startup, like you do every role. But as companies get larger and larger and larger, you're able to start making those differences between roles much more clear cut. And it is definitely to the advantage of the company to do that if they are able to. Sometimes you're not able to. And if you are in a position where you feel that you have to become a manager to move up in your career and you really don't want to, then maybe now's the time to not be at that company. Because as much as it's good to have some loyalty to your company, at the end of the day, you have to have loyalty to yourself. And if you put yourself in a position where you're not happy just because you thought like it was better for your career or it's better for the company, this is not right. This is not the right position. And you're better off going somewhere else and getting the right position. And the right position exists.
What is your opinion, Ethan, on just following up on this, right? Is what is your opinion on, or have you seen successful, let's call it all-rounders who are probably not too bad technically, right? But are also good at managing people. Have you seen characters like this, and how successful have they been?
Absolutely. So people like that do exist, though usually they end up having to split their time because they're unwilling to let go of some technical aspect that they're doing. And there was a different study that I don't know the reference to, but there has been work that suggests that you can only manage realistically seven people. At seven people, you're full-time working on management. You do not have time to write code. You do not have time to do your own thinking. You are just managing people and making sure their careers are going well. And you can, with seven people, that's it. That's your full-time, 100%. Mm-hmm. Five people, maybe you get to do a little bit of your own. There's an argument to be made that maybe going down to four or three people, if you want to be a 50-50, 50% individual contributor, 50% manager, that can be done. And there are certainly people that are capable of doing both. And that can and should be encouraged, because you want that technical mm-hmm. leadership as well as that managerial leadership. I find a lot of the best C-suite members that I've ever spoken to fit into that bucket, where they have a deep understanding of the industry they're in. They're able to provide that really strategic focus, where are we going? And then also manage really well the people that report to them. And ironically, the higher up in the org you go, the easier it is to manage people that report to you, because they're farther along in their career. They don't really need your management, right? So at the C-suite level, if you have a bunch of VPs reporting to you, like, your VPs aren't coming to you like, hey, man, I need to figure out my next role in my career, right? They already know what they're doing. So it's not necessary to manage them as much. And so then they get to, it's almost like as you get to that executive level, you get to start focusing more and more on strategy and your industry and your company, and less on management. But to get there, oftentimes you have to have either moved through management and have gotten or you have to move through technical. So for example, you could have someone that's extremely technical and really bad with people become a CTO. And that's fine. As long as that CTO has a bunch of VPs that know how to manage people, it'll be fine. But if you have a CTO that's extremely technically savvy and cannot manage people, and then you have them managing people that are not extremely experienced, those people are going to leave. And that's unfortunate. That's a loss that doesn't need to happen. So it's just really coming true to your own strengths and making sure that the role that you're in plays to those strengths. If you only want to be technical, then only be technical. If you only want to be a person manager, then only be a person manager. If you want to be somewhere in the middle, try to get that balance in your life. There's no clear cut thing that says, like, because you're a manager, you're absolutely not allowed to do technical work. That's not true. But as I said, if you're at seven people that you're managing, you probably don't have time to do anything technical. And so if you wanted to, you need to find a way to push some of those people off onto someone else, or add further hierarchy, have someone on your team be a manager themselves that reports to you, and have those people move under them, so that everybody kind of has the ability to do what they want. And if your company can't support that, then you have to take a good hard look at your career and decide if this is the right place for you or not. And no one will ever hold that against you. It's a free market out there. You should go find the position that makes you happy.
That's true. Yeah. This is very, very insightful, Ethan, but I'm going to change topics a little bit. And this may be a fun next segment. So Ethan, you and I talk, we were joking about an hour or two back that we talk about thrice a day, right? I think that's an average. And one of the things that came up in our discussions was your rules to live by, or your own personal commandments, right? So I want you, we did discuss that, but it was very insightful for me, but I think I want the world to know, right? So if you can please discuss them, but not just read them out, talk about the why behind it, and talk about if there's a backstory or if there is anything that led you to that thought, would be very insightful, Ethan, please.
Absolutely. So there's three rules that I kind of manage my life on. And some are darker than others, but I promise that I think of them positively. So we'll just go in order, and I'll go through background and what it means to me, and go on. So first, it could always be worse. My first rule is it can always be worse. Now, I thought I was being insightful with this. A lot of people might say, like, well, that's kind of pessimistic. Imagine all the ways this could go worse. I wonder if there's a cultural aspect to this. I actually got a book in the mail from I get these books in the mail for my daughter. And one of them was literally titled, "It Could Always Be Worse." And when I got the book, I was like, no way. And apparently this is like a Yiddish thing. And so maybe this is my own heritage speaking to me, that I learned this and never really realized that it's not my own novel idea, and that it's just, this is an idea that's in my culture, but it can only be worse. And the idea here is not actually as a negative thing, to think of all the ways it could be bad. It's more optimistic. So for example, maybe your computer breaks down. You're working on something. This was back, I thought of this when I was a graduate student, and someone was working, one of the researchers on the team was working, and her computer broke. And when I say broke, I mean just turned off one day and she wouldn't turn back on. And she was freaking out because she was doing research and she had all that work on it. Well, we were able to recover the hard drive and set up a new computer. And at the end of the day, you know, she lost a couple days of work, in the sense that she was waiting for a new computer to be able to process the data she was processing. But it could be worse. That hard drive could have been blown away and had no backups. And that would have been much, much worse. And so at the end of the day, this was a good thing, right? Because it makes you realize that, hey, I have to have backups in place. What do I do if something goes wrong? If you talk to anyone in InfoSec or data governance, you talk about a business continuity plan. And you know, when you do a tabletop for business continuity plans, they're awesome. It's something like you sit around a room and a lawyer comes to you and goes, okay, you walk to the office and the office is gone. It's gone. What do you do, right? It could always be worse, right? Maybe the city could be gone. Like, it could be something horrible could have happened, right? And the point being, it starts making you consider all the scenarios of what could happen and what could be worse, even if those things happen, and to build into place processes to avoid those things from occurring. Think of those worst case scenarios and put in a process in place to make sure it doesn't happen. It's very methodical. But also, when something bad happens, don't be too upset. It could always be worse. So it's a positive thing. Any questions on that?
No, this was very insightful, Ethan. All right. Yeah.
Next one. Life is unfair, and better that it is, otherwise we'd all get what we deserve. This is a bad paraphrasing from a quote that I heard. Now, I doubt this is where it originally comes from, but there was a show back in the 90s called Babylon 5. I'm a huge fan. It shouldn't surprise anyone that I'm a sci-fi nerd. And there was a character in Babylon 5. He's a ranger named Marcus Cole. And I pulled up the quote just so I could read it. The exact quote is, "I used to think it was awful that life was so unfair. Then I thought, wouldn't it be much worse if life were fair and all the terrible things that happen to us come because we actually deserve them? So now I take great comfort in the general hostility and unfairness of the universe." That's a very long quote. And so then I kind of shortened it a bit and just said, life is unfair and better that it is, otherwise we'd all get what we deserve. And so that was my shortening of it. And I'm pretty sure if someone does some digging that that quote actually comes from somewhere else. They always do. They're always like layers of quotes and quotes. The history of languages is a fascinating topic. But the moral of the story here is I generally try not to think too much of my own success as my own success. Some of it is luck. A lot of it is luck. And I don't think of when something bad happens to somebody else that that is a reflection on them doing something bad. A lot of it is luck. Luck influences a significant amount of our lives, and that's okay. You have to accept that both the good and the bad have an element of luck to it, both on yourself and on others. And so it's really around, don't judge people. It's kind of don't judge people too harshly, lest ye be judged. Right. And really when you take that to heart, when bad things happen to you, instead of going, oh, life is so unfair, it shouldn't be this way, right? You instead focus on, what do I have control over that I can change? What can I do to work around the fact that I got tossed an unfortunate situation? And that's the best you can do, because certainly life isn't going to fix it for you. You can't just wait for the universe to revolve around you to fix itself, right? You should instead, take the initiative to go and fix things yourselves if you have the power.
All right. Is there a third? Okay. Yeah. Okay.
There's a third. Yeah. Third one. This is the one most relevant to work in particular. Work is infinite. That's it. Work is infinite. And so now that has a lot of layers to it. First, it means you're never going to finish it because it's infinite. No matter how much work, if you decide to work 80 hours this week, you're not going to finish the work, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to keep going until one day you retire, and then one day you die. And the work will never be completed. And you have to internalize and be okay with that fact, that you can't do it all. And working extra won't enable you to do it all because it can't be done. Instead, focus on what you can do. Be proud of the work that you do. Do work that you are proud of. Don't be focused on finishing the stack of tasks. Because if you do manage to finish the stack of tasks, you're just going to get more tasks. And they're not going to be better tasks or more meaningful tasks. You're just going to stress yourself out. And so at the same time, this also is has a play on work-life balance, right? Which is to say, getting more work done isn't going to magically allow you to have work-life balance. You're not going to finish all the work. So instead, you have to enable yourself to acknowledge that your life is part of the things you have to balance. And don't worry about, oh, I have this many projects, so I don't get to go out to dinner, I don't get to spend time with friends, or I don't get to spend time with my family, right? Instead, you have to carve that time out and keep it kind of holy to yourself, and accept the fact that that just means you're not going to get all the work done. And that's okay. You're human. You're not going to get all the work done. And even if you weren't human and you were able to do all of that, more would have appeared, right?
Yeah.
You're never going to finish. If you're working on tickets, I've been a ticket jockey. I've had a pile of tickets from customers with support requests, and you're never going to finish them. No matter how fast you go, you're never going to finish them. And if you do, by some miracle, finish them, new work is going to appear that's not tickets, that maybe is interesting at first because of the diversity, but eventually you're going to get sick of that too, right? And so instead of being focused on finishing it, be focused on what you have finished. Don't worry about what you're going, all the things you're going to get done. Worry about what you will get done, and then focus on that. And then when you do it, be proud of what you did. You have infinite work to do, so don't stress. And when you have a changing priority, you're doing something and some new priority comes in, and you're like, ah, you ruined, I had a plan. It doesn't matter, because work is infinite. Don't get stressed. Work is infinite. You just work on the thing that's important at the moment, and take the punches as they come, because, again, you're never going to finish it. You're never going to win. So don't bother trying. Instead, focus on doing good work and being happy.
The thing is, while all of them may seem negative, right, they're actually a very positive way of looking at life. Meaning, it's saying that, hey, look at the bright side. It could be worse, in the sense that I mean, it's just this, don't lose hope, don't lose heart, right? So look at the bright side. Life is unfair, yes, but look at the bright side, right? And sometimes life could be unfair in a positive way. You probably got more than what you deserved, right? Like some, you know, sometimes you have friends and family who are probably, you're like, oh my God, how did I land up with someone? How am I so lucky that I know this person, right? Or this person walked into my life, right? So that's also a way of unfair in the sense that you've gotten more than you deserve. And work is infinite is, while it sounds negative, it's a way of reminding people that learn to draw your boundaries. And sometimes boundaries are stretchable. Sometimes there are, people have 70, 80 hour weeks, and sometimes there are 30 hour weeks, but make sure you plan around that. So it's very, again, so yeah, I mean, I've told you this before, Ethan, that I like this a lot, and that you had to talk about this. So the next one is also kind of testament to, sometimes you and I, we talk about something and then we talk about some, of course, a lot of our calls are very work related, very structured, but sometimes we do talk about things that are off topic, but also intellectually stimulating. So I think the third one that I have is, one, daylight savings, so good or bad. And if it is bad, then EST versus EDT. So your thoughts, Ethan.
So daylight savings is bad. I think the science is pretty aligned on it's bad. And there was, this topic came up in a discussion between us a while ago, because there was a bill in front of Congress, I think promoted by Marco Rubio, was around getting rid of daylight savings time and just keeping it EDT, which is always daylight savings time. The D stands for daylight, right? And you and I are on East Coast time. And so hence we're using East Coast time, but this is true for all times, specifically in the United States, but and around the world, daylight savings is a thing. And there was pushback from the scientific community against EDT because standard time is the right time. You want noon to be when the sun is directly above your head or as close to it as possible. Daylight, the entire point of daylight time is that you moved that off by an hour, right? Mm-hmm. And so the scientific community was saying, no, based on your natural circadian rhythm, you want to be on standard time. So yes, we support getting rid of the switch of 1 hour, but don't do it to be on EDT all the time. Be on EST all the time, because you're naturally attuned to being on EST. And so yeah, I generally support what science has to say. I'm in no position to suggest that a biologist does not know the answer to this question, because clearly they do. You could always take this further and go, well, what does this have to do? Like, there was a time before standard time zones. I think it came from the train industry in like the Industrial Revolution, like late 1800s, early 1900s, where every city had their own clock, and that was how time worked. There was a good podcast on this, and I'm trying to remember which one it was. It might have been like 99% Invisible, which, if people don't listen to, really good. That or Planet Money or one of them was about this. And I feel like it's a fascinating topic, how we got to standardized time zones, which was like to make sure trains arrived on time and everyone agreed when a train was going to arrive. Because if one town said it was 11:05 and another said it was 11:02, which one is right? How do you judge it? And then like trains might actually collide, and it was like a whole thing. So you create standardized time zones, and then you had to layer on that, you know, based on time of getting up and doing your farming and all that sort of process, where daylight time came in, I believe. Though that could just be what I was taught, and that's all a lie. I'm curious about that. But certainly, I think there is agreement in the scientific community, from what I've seen and read, that daylight time is bad, and that we should just be on standard time all the time and move on with our lives, which means summers end up, we're in daylight time. No, Are we?
I think we're on daylight time now.
Daylight time right now.
Yeah.
And so if you were on standard time, right, we did a spring forward, which means you lost an hour. So imagine the sun being up even an hour later than it already is, right? That would be, you're talking about, 10 p.m., the sun going down, which means fireworks on the 4th of July will be really late at night. So my 4-year-old won't get to go see fireworks. Won't
get to see it. Yes.
Right. But the price you pay to have a stable psyche is maybe worth it.
That's true. Yeah. And So actually you remind me about the 4-year-old, where I think in our next conversation, we should probably talk about some of the rules that you try to live by when you're around kids. And I know that was one of the conversations we had as one of the billion times that we've spoken, Ethan. So, but again, I think, yeah, I agree that, at least the switching of times is not good. So we should at least have one time, right? And not this 1 hour forward, backward. So I agree with that. And I think it looks like the science, based on what you're saying, it should be Eastern Standard Time. So it should be EST and not Eastern Daylight Time. So yeah. Though strangely, I tend to like my schedule during EDT, and then my EST schedule is not as good. But I don't know if that's a winter thing. So
I wonder if in winter it's just dark and you're sad, and maybe you're like, ST is the worst. But in summer you're happy because it's warm, and like you're up in Canada, right? So it's extra.
Yeah, it's worse. Yeah. Everything's just more amplified here, Ethan. So with that, Ethan, so phase one, I think this was all the list of questions I had for you. It was, as always, it's great talking to you, and we have plans to do something more and bigger, right? So hopefully that works out, and if it does, then I'm sure you'll find Ethan and me in a different conversation. So fingers crossed on that. But irrespective of that, the outcome of that, Ethan, I think it was great talking to you. It's always fun. So thanks a lot and very insightful.